Everyone, it's Wednesday, January 8th. You're tuned into The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. A little overcast, a little snow, and I don't know about you, but I'm not sleeping. I'm pacing. I'm waking up. I'm trying to figure out what his reaction is. As we come on the air, Donald Trump has just finished his press conference. Of course, he took no questions. I think because they told him if he took a question, they would give him a knuckle sandwich, because if he isn't either on script offering their lies, he was afraid that he would go off script and offer his lies, which is really what the essence of it is. And I saw an interesting tweet, Ken. And the tweet basically said, well, what we're seeing is the standard Trump play. Create an unnecessary crisis, claim credit for it when it doesn't become an even worse crisis, and then sit back and watch the pundits clap at him and say, oh, look what you've done. You've saved us. And it is just – it is shocking. And I was mentioning to you as I came in that I saw an L.A. Times article, and I posted this on Facebook. And this is the L.A. Times article from this morning. Israel had advanced notice of U.S. plan to kill Iranian General Soleimani, report says. And I wrote, of course he did. Here's the Donald Trump checklist. Call Bibi. Call Lindsay. Don't call Nancy. Okay? I just want everyone to know. This is just incredible. The enemy are Democrats. We are the enemy. Understand he will do anything to basically undermine, harm. I said it before, that before the assassination of Soleimani, he assassinated the democratic process. That's what Donald Trump has done. He has assassinated the democratic process. There is nothing true. No rules apply to him. There's no game plan. He doesn't plan ahead. As someone, I think it was Seth Abramson said, what is clear from what just happened is that there is no plan. There is no strategy. Right now, whatever Iran does, we're going to respond to that, because he doesn't know what he's doing. And everyone, the Europeans, the Chinese, the Russians, they're all on one side and we are on the other. And he's ordering them to follow his lead. Why? Right. And where is he going? Where is he going? What lead? Lead to where? All right, I'm calm.
Oh, sure you are.
Yeah.
Well, it's just so striking that he's doing this, and all the talk afterwards of – I mean, not that it's been that long. It's only 15 minutes. But after the speech is about a lot of things, but you sit back and you think Russia is the only real winner here. They're sitting back and sort of watching the U.S. and its allies in the Middle East destroy itself and destroy each other.
And they're gonna
just sitting there like the cat that ate the canary.
No, but they love it, because they're going to come in and they're going to renegotiate. They're going to be the peacemakers.
Yeah.
Because understand, what Donald Trump did was alienate our European supporters. Okay, he's ticked them off on every single level by not contacting them or informing them, because they have people in the theater that can be hurt and killed. He didn't inform them. He obviously informed Bibi. And now this is the perfect opportunity for Putin to come in saying, hey, you know, we're friends with the Iranians. We understand what Donald Trump has done to you, Europe. Why don't we sit down and figure out how to negotiate this and leave us out of the conversation, because we've actually created the crisis.
Yeah, and Trump has created a scenario in the whole world where the whole world has that attitude. The U.S. is just too untrustworthy and unreliable to form any kind of agreement with, or to do anything except be scared and watch out that we don't nuke them too. He has to ask our allies, our closest allies, NATO and Europe, on the air, in public, to please join with us, support us in
– You mean the NATO he's been trashing? The NATO that they haven't paid for? You mean the NATO that – I mean, let's remember, God.
Yeah, but I mean, you use the words he's ticked them off, but it's more than just showing them a lack of respect. He has done actions and made policies that work to their detriment, that work to their long-term detriment, by disincluding them from the planning process and then just asking them to jump on board after the fact. And it's not a recipe for winning friends and influencing people. And the United States is going to have a hard time recovering from that in a post-Trump era.
But he's hollowed out our administration.
And then he's hollowed out our democracy as well. Yeah.
So Garrett Graff wrote this morning. Reminder that as this crisis escalates, we have No director of national intelligence. No deputy director of national intelligence. No Homeland Secretary, Security Secretary. No deputy secretary of Homeland Security. No head of CPB or ICE. No State Department under the Secretary of Arms Control. No Assistant Secretary for Europe. No Navy Secretary. And that's just the beginning of the list. That's just the beginning of the list. So he has hollowed us out. The only people that are around him are the hawks, as we know, his vice president, as well as Pompeo, and frankly, Bolton, who's probably screaming into the wind and going, yes, 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 keep going, keep going. Go down. I mean, it is so shocking. And here's my problem. Even if he did have those people in place, he doesn't listen to them. He doesn't care. He doesn't want to hear anything that doesn't feed whatever is his agenda of the moment, and that changes by the moment. Oh my God.
Yeah, some of the things that he said that should have been soothing, which would have been soothing if we had any basis for believing him, are just pie in the sky. He said Iran is standing down. What makes you think that Iran is standing down? You just did this.
Idea.
We don't know what they're going to do. And I'm sure they're not telling the Donald what their plans are for the future.
Let's remember, they're not going to call us up about the cybersecurity attacks. They're not going to call us up when all the proxies suddenly start coming out. Because remember, Iran isn't just about the nation of Iran. I mean, that was what was so effective about Soleimani, was that he had so many proxies around the world that were working with him. And frankly, what do we know about those proxies? That you actually don't control them. You might assist them, but ultimately you don't control them. And he's created a crisis, and I'm not sure.
And he's asking Iran to work with us in fighting ISIS. Well, do you seriously think that after the way we've been treating Iran that they're going to work with us? But Trump said ISIS is dead just a couple of months ago. Of course,
that's not true.
Of course, ISIS is now out and about and gaining power because Trump withdrew U.S. troops in Kurdistan Kurdistan, and there's nobody left to contain the ISIS people, so they're out building.
It's going to be crazy. All right, so today, everyone, we are not going to focus on this, and the reason we're not going to focus on this is that we need to digest, if it's possible, to sort of see what he said, the response to what he said. Obviously, the briefing that's being given right now to members of Congress, something that was not given to them before. And I think it's important for us to sort of sit back, breathe. And then tomorrow we'll have Bill Curry from Connecticut and Stefan Schmidt joining us on Thursday, and we'll have an opportunity to sort of maybe play this out a little bit better with a little more information at our fingertips, because an exchange of ignorance is exactly what feeds Donald Trump, and I don't want to aid and abet that. So I saw an interesting article, and it was at Vox.com. And this article, everyone, in some ways is not only interesting, but I could relate to it on so many levels because it is personal. And the title of the piece at Vox.com was "Women Donate to Multiple Candidates, but Men Tend to Stick to People Who Look Like Them." And as I was thinking about this, I suddenly realized in a lot of ways it described my political behavior. Someone called me up a couple of months ago, and they asked me who I was supporting. And here's exactly what I said. I swear to God. I said, well, I see four or five candidates that interest me. I see four or five candidates that I would like to sort of know more about, see them on the campaign trail, give them an opportunity to figure out whether they can connect with people. My recommendation to you is send a check, not to one, but to all of them. Don't look. I mean, at this point, you're dating. You don't know who you're going to marry. I'm frankly not going to know who I'm going to support until the day of the election. I'll be honest with you. People keep saying, that's just not true, Arnie. Trust me, that is so wicked true. But as I'm looking at this scenario out here, and I'm thinking of what I recommended to these individuals who are calling me saying, what should I do? And I basically said, there's a really impressive bench. It is the most diverse bench we have ever had. And there are some really credible people on the bench, but nobody will know if we don't give them the opportunity because they can't self-fund. They're not a Mayor Bloomberg. They're not a Tom Steyer. So my recommendation is send a check to all of them. And that will be a way for them to maintain their viability. Well, it turns out that I am a poster child for women because according to Grace Haley, that's exactly what women do. Women donate to multiple candidates, but men tend to stick to people who look like them. Grace, I want your job. I'm just telling you. As I was reading what you cover And the issues that you look at, and of course, I've actually dealt a lot with Rutgers, and Rutgers is a lot about women in politics. I realized in some ways who women are and how they approach politics is so different from men. And maybe it's because we have never really been in positions of power. Maybe it's because we are the caretakers, and caretakers realize that no one comes to the table as the most virtuous. Therefore, we need to elevate as many people as possible. But it was just so interesting how women approach politics. And I think it's important for us to understand why there's real virtue in that, because they don't necessarily relate on gender. But they look for so much more. They look at the gestalt.
Yeah, I mean, it's this interesting period where all of these traditional paths to political influence and political power that have been so dominated by men for so long, are that gap, that fundraising gap, and that gender gap is closing for the Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. And trying to understand the historic influences that led that to happen, the political influence, the local organizing on a state level that led up to this moment, these past few years. It's a really interesting job to have.
Well, you know, it's so I was the first woman to run for governor. And I remember when we filed our first paperwork with the amount of money that we had raised. And this was during the primary. There were three people running on the Democratic side, a party chairman, a five-term congressman, and myself, a backbencher from the New Hampshire legislature, of which there are 400. On the Republican side, it was the president of the Senate. It was the attorney general under Governor Sununu at the time. And it was a powerful female Republican chair of the Finance Committee. Now, remember I told you I'm a backbencher. I'm in my mid-30s. I have two babies. I drive a 13-year-old Subaru. When we came that night to look at what happened, we had outraised everyone with tiny, tiny checks. All right? And it was shocking to the media. This is 1992. But we understood that we had to prove ourselves on every level. Not only did we have to raise more money than them, but we needed to show a diversity of support and that we are willing to go everywhere and encourage everyone to write a check. And the check didn't have to have a comma in it, but it had to have a person behind it.
Yeah. I mean, this gets at the point with how important fundraising is in primaries and early on in the race, where not only do you need money to pay staff members or to run ads, or to print out materials for volunteers to do a grassroots campaign for, but it signals and it builds momentum of who is a viable candidate. And trying to understand how gender plays into viability with who's able to run for an election in the first place is super attached to fundraising and those first initial moments within primaries, how much a candidate is able to raise.
Well, so let me ask you a question. You didn't hear me because I was waxing poetic before you came on the air. But I had said to my audience that I had a couple of people call me in the early part of 2019, and they asked me who I liked. And I mentioned that I liked four or five of the different candidates of the 20-some-odd candidates that were running. And I thought we had a really interesting bench, very diverse. I saw a lot of people that could possibly be in the cabinet. I thought I referred to it as sort of like the cabinet in waiting as much as, you know, people running for president. And when they asked me what should they do, my recommendation to them was that send checks to four or five. I said, how can you pick one now? And frankly, 5 months from now and a year from now, if you support and send checks to all these people, you will see how they grow during the campaign. You will see how they connect with people. You are giving them a chance to be able to sort of show their presidential skill set. They don't walk into this job. They don't walk into running knowing it. Why do women give this kind of advice, do this kind of thing, and men basically take out their wad and say, just to you? I'm trying to figure out, what is it about boys that they think they have to pick one and stick with one when women are so willing to sort of diversify that investment and recognize there are many ways of, you know, getting to God and not just one?
Right. And I guess it's not as polarized in the data, where a lot of these women donor circles that have been popping up in the 2000s, their priority is to get more women elected to office. And so for them, it's it sometimes seems like a statistical probability call, where if you try to get as many women seen as competitive candidates, then they're more like, then your goal, which is to have more women elected to office, seems more likely, where there's not at the same time these donor circles that are outwardly organizing to get more men elected to office. So there's kind of a difference in what the goals are. And this is also happening at a moment where we are seeing some data that men are donating to multiple candidates, just not as often as women are. So I can't really say anything about that point too dramatically, but...
Well, but you, what was interesting to me is if you go to your article, you actually list the candidates who got the most money from women. And what I thought was so fascinating was numero uno was Julian Castro. Isn't that fascinating? And who did Julian Castro suddenly come out and endorse? Yeah. Elizabeth Warren. I'm like, ooh, isn't there was an interesting connection there. And I think Beto, even though he dropped out of the race, I think he was like number two. So in a bizarre way, even as women are willing to invest in women, understanding how important that is, they're also willing to look beyond it, and they're really looking at sort of their issue spotting. And they're saying, who will bring the kind of stability or the kind of issue security we want? And I'm not surprised that Julian got so many women to support him, in part because I think women are very sensitive to the whole immigration story that's been coming out. The caging of the children, the separating of the families, realizing that the changing demographic is, I don't necessarily want to have babies, but we need more young people. How could we not open our immigration doors? I mean, I'll be honest with you. I want to see a changing demographic in America, and I don't necessarily want my children to have more children. What I would prefer to see happen is that we open our doors and invite more young people into this country, because it only adds to our economic strength and the kind of diversity that we're going to need going forward. So to me, that Julian was number one is both interesting, but I think it's a story that needs to be told.
Right. And if you look at some of the data that's been coming out from the Center for American Women in Politics, they did polling looking at which issues women care most about. And those are healthcare reform, gun regulations, income inequality, race relations, and education for Democratic women.
Mm-hmm.
And we're seeing, especially in the Democratic primaries, how so many candidates are embracing these issues that are being prioritized by Democratic women. It's not super surprising when you're looking at the issues that people care most about, and we're looking at candidates like Castro and Beto O'Rourke, who talk so much about race relations and immigration and gun safety.
The soft issues, issues. That's right. The female/ soft issues is what they were talking about.
And Bernie Sanders, who embraces healthcare so much with his platform, and who most voters equate healthcare reform with Bernie Sanders, he has the most money coming from women overall. In proportion-wise, he's only getting 40% of his total dollars coming from women, but he has the most money coming from women. And healthcare is the number one issue that Democratic women care about. So, and we saw this play out in the 2018 midterms as well.
There's no question about it. So I was thinking about a conversation I had at a lunch many, many years ago at Dartmouth College. And I'm sitting there with a father and his two daughters. And his two daughters were, one was about to attend as a freshman at Dartmouth. And of course, Dartmouth had gone co-ed many, many years before. And during the course of the conversation, he started trashing the concept of affirmative action. And I was sitting at the table and I went, really? You don't like affirmative action? I said, you know who benefited the most from affirmative action? Your daughters, girls, not people of color, women benefited the most from affirmative action. And one of the things in your article is that the reason is that if men are in control and men have the power and men have the money, guess what they tend to do? They tend to vie with men, usually white men, who have more, have equal amounts of power. It's like the idea is you do with what is familiar. And if you are in a power position and an employment position and a recruitment position, you are going to do what is familiar. And what is the story about affirmative action was it forced us to make other people part of the conversation and force them to become familiar because there was no other way to do it because you that men would not embrace it. And in an interesting way, this story that you're telling here is not only are we seeing more women participating, but as a result of their participation, the issues that women care about are now rising to the top. And those are ultimately the issues that are going to provide us with the most economic security and stability. Military budgets, not so much. Healthcare, absolutely. Which
yeah,
I think
right.
is absolutely. So as you were looking at this and you were talking with folks at Rutgers, what do they also say about bringing more women of color into the political process? Because we know that there's this constant appeal. I mean, that's Joe Biden's ace in the hole. He goes, look at me, South Carolina, people of color. I'm the only one that's really resonating with them. Well, one of the big challenges I would think is that if women, especially black women, are so important, how do black women run and win? What do they have to do?
Right. So this is a really important perspective because it's pivotal to take an intersectional approach when we're yep. looking at this because white women have significantly more advantages in fundraising, especially compared to black women, where in 2018, we were looking at multivariate analyses in fundraising in the general election, and we found that black women significantly had greater hurdles and fundraising struggles in 2018 compared to white women candidates. While there's this idea that we can talk a lot about gender, but race is just as important in this conversation.
And the reason I take it is that if it's difficult for women to establish themselves and prove their political credentials, it's even harder for black women to prove themselves because they've got not only the gender dynamic working against them, they've got the race dynamic working against them. So in order for them to prove themselves, they don't have to raise as much as everyone else. They have to outraise everyone in order to be even equally competitive. I think people don't quite get that. I always talk about the kids that come into kindergarten. The kids that come into kindergarten from affluent communities, they need a couple of $1,000 to start them in kindergarten. Kids that come from, to challenging communities where they aren't read to, where they're latchkey kids, no one's home, they don't have the benefits, they're not getting the vocabulary. They need 10 times the amount of money starting in kindergarten. They're both 5 years old, but they start at very different places in order to achieve. That's actually also true when you're talking about women of color running for office because they have that many more hurdles to be able to overcome to say, see, I am worthy of this. I am someone who should be elected to this.
Right. And it goes back to the gatekeeping of who is able to and who is able and capable of running to office for the first place, where often even white women gatekeep women of color from these same offices and elections that we would hope would be able to be open up to an array of people to be able to be part of the political process.
Well Grace, you are a researcher at the Center for Responsive Politics. You also wrote this article at Vox.com. Someday I would ask you to take a look at Emily's List. Emily's List stands for Early Money is Like Yeast. Supposedly, they're the group that understands this idea of getting this money together and investing in women. Find out who they invest in. Find out the old girls they invest in, the old girls that look more like the old boys. It would be really interesting to track and see what Emily's List did to bring the diversity of women up, the diversity of voices of women, and to see who they basically stepped on and didn't support. And to me, a pox on Emily's List, because instead of recognizing that it was really in there, it would have behooved them to really sort of look at these diversity of candidates, they did not. In an ironic way, they were the old boy network with a girl's name. Just going to tell you that, Grace. I know too much.
Right.
Anyway.
I can't speak to that, but I do know that we have that data at opensecrets.org. You can look at Emily's List and see who they are donating to.
Right.
But I haven't
right.
done
and,
that with the third quarter fundraising numbers.
Well,
so
and I'm not even saying that today. I think you need to look at the arc of history. You need to go back to when they began. You need to look at what they did. And when you begin to look at who they supported, who they bundled for, who they noticed, you'll begin to notice that if there was a progressive voice, if there was perhaps a voice of color, that those people weren't necessarily embraced. So in an ironic way, even though they talked about investing in women, you have to look at the narrow scope of women that they made the decision to invest in. And that's the dirty little secret about Emily's List, that I think if you want to know why women are so challenged today, in an ironic way, Emily's List is part of the problem, which I think is just so shocking. Anyway, thank you so much, Grace. It'll be really interesting to see what happens in 2020. And I got to talk to Julian Castro about all those females donating to him. I think it's just amazing. All right, take care. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Women in politics and money, I know too much. All right, on that note, a little labor history is next. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1939. That was the day a new radio show began on CBS Radio.
Welcome to the Motion Picture Star's own radio program, The Gulfstream Guild Show, with Jack Benny, Joan Crawford, Reginald Gardner.
The show featured some of the biggest names in Hollywood. All of the actors' fees were donated to the Motion Picture Relief Fund. The fund was started in 1922 with the motto of taking care of our own. Proceeds from the show went to support the motion picture Country Home for Retired Workers in the film industry. These included actors, cameramen, set designers, and even security guards. These retired workers only paid what they could afford to live there. Eventually, the retirement home allowed working people from the television industry as well. Gulf Oil sponsored the program for its first three seasons. It was called the Gulfstream Guild Show. Over the years, the show took on several other sponsors and names. It also migrated to NBC, then to ABC, and then back to CBS Radio. In all, it ran for 14 seasons and more than 500 episodes. In its early years, the show was a variety review. It included songs along with dramatic and comedy sketches. Later, the show recreated films for the radio audience. It was a challenge to get a whole film down to just 22 minutes. Films covered by the show included classics such as Casablanca, Arsenic and Old Lace, and Pinocchio. But despite the changes and challenges, the show raised $800,000 for the retirement home by 1942. The retirement home was almost closed in 2009, but continues operations. Workers in many industries have long found creative and collaborative ways to support each other and to truly take care of their own. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. You may enjoy gazing out the window and seeing familiar birds, like goldfinches, robins, or warblers, flitting between tree branches. But as the climate warms, many bird species will need to leave some of the places they've long considered home.
These areas just become no longer suitable and they'll have to move to new areas.
Brooke Bateman is a senior scientist at the National Audubon Society. She says for bird lovers who want to visualize what this means in their own yards, Audubon created an online tool. Users can enter a zip code and learn more about local climate threats and the risks they pose to birds.
It really gives you a local snapshot of what's happening with climate change.
The tool highlights which species will no longer find suitable local habitat by the end of the century. Users can toggle between different levels of future warming so they can see that without climate action,
oh, these birds that come to my feeder or these birds I see in my backyard, they're not going to be there anymore.
But if carbon pollution is sharply reduced, the risk to many species are too. The tool shows how climate action can help your favorite birds return to your feeder year after year. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Well, it's so hot to face that in this day and age, somebody's race can drink a somebody's race. Somebody's preference can drive some total stranger to make somebody somehow feel the wrath of their anger. Why don't we put in one forward and show? Show her and put in two heads. Be racist, be sexist, be bigots, be sure. We won't stand for your hate. Now, why's it cut and dry?
a simple concept list. Give tolerance a try and this confusion still exists. Ignorant mongers know areas gray. Could be any wronger in this age today. Why would we put in what for and show?
We won't stand for your hate. Hate. Oh, I know, Donald Trump. Anyway, this is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. So who sings, let's face it, we won't stand for your hate? That's really harsh.
Let's face it, was by the Mighty Bosstones. I thought not standing for your hate would be appropriate for this next discussion we're going to have.
All right, so let me tell you how I set it up on Facebook, because I always like how I sort of frame things. And then we will get to our reporter from HuffPost. Trump's 2020 theme, feed the rich, starve the poor. As Arthur points out, this is one of several unilateral policy changes the Trump administration is pushing without Congress. Others targeted housing, food benefits, and health care as part of Trump's inaugural vow to kick people off welfare. Now, the Democrats' 2020 theme should be the following. Vote the narcissistic, unstable, vindictive SOB out of office. Folks, there is no one he will not cut off at the knees. And the irony is that most of the people being hurt by his war on welfare are living in the very states that voted for him. We have to save them from him. The title of the article at HuffPost.com was Trump Administration Quietly Goes After Disability Benefits. And I thought, you know, as we're focusing on everything else, we need to know how insidious he is and what he is doing because our eyes are being distracted. Arthur Delaney joins us. He started working for Huffington Post in 2009. He covers politics and the economy. He previously wrote for the Washington City Paper, The Hill, Slate Magazine, and ABCNews.com. Welcome to the program, Arthur.
Thanks for having me.
So let's talk about this disability thing. Unbelievable. And, of course, a lot of people don't understand that Social Security is not just the retirement check that you get. There is also Social Security disability, and it is part of the umbrella of what Social Security serves and who it serves.
That's right. It's called Social Security Disability Insurance. Just like the retirement insurance, it's paid for through a payroll tax.
And yes.
Your eligibility for it is based on your own earnings history.
So let's talk a little bit about what he is proposing to do, why he can do this without congressional approval, and why so many people in the disability community are apoplectic about who it's going to hurt.
Through the federal rulemaking process, the Trump administration is pushing a proposed rule. It hasn't been finalized yet, mm-hmm. So this is still a ways off, but presumably they want to get it done this year. It's a proposed rule that will ramp up continuing disability reviews of people who are receiving Social Security disability insurance. So these are reviews that happen already. Once you have been awarded disability insurance, you know, every few years, depending on the severity of your disability, you tell the government, "Yep, I'm still disabled." And what the new proposal is for. It would say that the government would do more reviews. It would check in more frequently with certain types of claimants, and the effect of this would be that an uncertain number of people would lose their benefits.
So do you know what the timetable is now? How often do they check in? What are they talking about? Are they targeting certain individuals? I mean, and why would the idea that you check in with someone to see if they're still disabled be such a threat?
Well, there are. It depends on your disability. When you are awarded benefits, they put you into three diary categories that are based on your likelihood of medical improvement.
Mm-hmm.
And so, if you've got like ALS, say they're not going
right.
to say you're likely
come back.
To improve.
Right. Exactly.
But Republicans have been sort of shaking their fists at people who they think are malingering. That have questionable musculoskeletal or mental health problems.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're going after people who they think, ought to improve.
Mm-hmm.
And so the timeline for this, they're creating a new category of review in addition to the three that already exist. And this one would have the government checking in on people within 2 years of when they're awarded benefits. Right now, some people who are in this category would not have to do a review for more than 3 years. So
okay.
it's ramping up. There will be about 2 million more reviews than there would have been otherwise as a result of this, if it gets finalized.
Okay, so I'm looking at another article. So as soon as you put this out there, I'm like thinking, okay, so have we done this before? What's the cost-benefit analysis? I mean, screwing the poor always sells well to the base, because after all, why should Amazon pay anything in taxes when you can take away someone's, you know, $150 a week or whatever it is that they get? And for whatever reason, that kind of harshness seems to appeal, especially to Donald Trump's base. And there's a guy by the name of Jeffrey Friedman, and he wrote, it's just so interesting. He writes, "Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it." And he goes on to a comment by Winston Churchill that basically says, "Americans seem to have a very short memory. In the 1980s, Ronald Reagan implemented a cutback on Social Security disability that resulted in 200,000 people losing their benefits and the deaths of thousands of beneficiaries, including several by suicide." Okay? In spite of that fact, Reagan's action was reversed after a public outcry. The current administration in Washington wants to implement a similar regulation that will result in millions of SSD and supplemental security income beneficiaries having to prove their benefits more frequently. The United States disability eligibility requirements are already stricter. Now listen to this, are already stricter than any country in the developed world. I mean, this is what is so amazing. And more, this is the other part of the statistic, which is why the hell are they doing this? More than half the applicants, Arthur, are denied.
Yeah.
So what's the point? And if we're actually looking at who you're going to harm, how much it's going to cost to implement this, why the hell would you do it?
That's right. It doesn't save a ton of money. It's going to be expensive to do because it's work for the government. But I think you pointed to the likely reason, which is that it sells well to certain voters. And this is an interesting thing about it. Unlike a lot of the sort of wacky stuff with Trump, the corruption, the crazy statements, the warmongering, this is more like traditional
Republican
stuff.
It's
along the lines of makers and takers that we've heard from Republicans for decades. So it's something that it really leverages a lot of history and a lot of the way some voters think of the government and who benefits from the government and who doesn't. And it's something that definitely fires up a big subset of Republican voters.
Well, you know, and the other thing is, as I was reading your article, I went back to it, and I think I may have even sent you a note. I mean, he's cutting off 700,000 people from food stamps. You know, and here's the kicker. I don't know if you saw this story, but there was a report that came out, and they were looking at from 2008 to 2004 to 2018. Okay, and they were looking at, you know, who survived the economic meltdown, who recovered from the economic meltdown, what's happening in this good economy, and what they found out was there was only one group of people that actually saw their incomes decline. Not stabilize, not increase, but decline. And it was the poorest Americans. So even as we know that, you know, a good economy is supposed to lift all boats, apparently one part of the boat never got lifted. In fact, not only did it not get lifted, but their incomes declined. And now he's shafting them with their Social Security disability benefits. He's shafting them with food stamps. He's making it more difficult for them to access health care. And he's actually hurting their housing. I mean, it's like, what does he want them to do, disappear?
It's very similar to the food stamps proposal that you mentioned, in that it's going around Congress. They're doing it through regulation, through essentially the same process. The disability and the food benefit cuts are both going through this unilateral regulatory process, and that means Congress can't stop it. But it also means that they may be vulnerable to lawsuits and maybe, you know, less permanent than if they had been passed as a law. So that's an important thing to keep in mind about these regulations.
Well, you know, I know we were calling you in D.C., so obviously, did you get a chance to sort of get the reaction to whatever Donald Trump was saying at his press conference this morning? Because I keep thinking about that's part of the problem, is that we don't have the capacity to focus anymore. You know, someone was asking me about the 2020 campaign and how, you know, at the beginning there was like 20 or 24 candidates and what did I think of them? And I'm thinking, I can't even hold on to six. And you're asking me about 24. And it's like, you know, and I was getting very nervous because it was very difficult for me to do any kind of rational analysis. Plus, let's be honest, it was frankly exhausting. And when I looked at your story and then I looked at your tweet about how this sort of fits into the old Republican sort of line about the takers and the givers, it's that we don't have the capacity to even focus on this. And yet it's ironic who gets hurt, because it will be people in Kentucky. It will be people in Tennessee. It will be people in Texas. And those are the states that have historically voted for him. And it's just going to drain the financial coffers of those states because the federal government is taking away those resources.
Yeah. Speaking of focus, I mean, this thing has not had very much focus at all. There have been a few news stories about it, but it was first, this draft regulation on disability was first announced back in November. And even I didn't notice it back then. And lawmakers are only beginning to become more aware of it. In December, Democrats sent a letter saying, whoa, what are you doing? Like, this hasn't been vetted. You've got to push it back. And the Trump administration actually did push it back by about 2 weeks. Yeah. Democrats think it ought to be delayed another few months. But I think the reason it came out now, even in this sort of seemingly not fully ready form, is that they want to get it done before the end of the first term.
Oh, absolutely.
Because if you finish it at the end, though, it becomes more vulnerable to being overturned by Congress in the next year. So they want to get it done now, and they don't really need to draw a ton of attention to it.
Well, it'll be really interesting because we have this next debate coming up. The debate in Iowa comes up next week. And obviously now foreign policy is going to be a huge domination of the conversation, where historically it's been more of domestic policy, healthcare, climate change, that kind of thing. But I think in a lot of ways, these kinds of stories, I would hope that the Des Moines Register, I would hope that CNN pays attention to this, because I think it's really important for people to know that this is what they're doing. Then they don't need congressional approval. This is just harmful because they have the power to harm. And I think that's where people need to begin to understand this. And just that statement that half of the people that apply for Social Security disability are denied tells you that this is not frivolous, that this isn't given to anybody that walks in and says, my back hurts, and the consequences not only to those individuals, but to their families are enormous. Yes, Ken?
I just want to add, you asked earlier, Arnie, why is this such a threat? And one of the answers, Arthur spoke to the merits of it, but also one of the answers is precisely this coming down harshly and giving short shrift to people who are vulnerable, people with disabilities, right, other poor people, food stamps, all of that. Because one thing that happens that I learned from being a public benefits lawyer at Legal Aid is that a lot of people miss their appointments for these recertifications.
Exactly.
It's theoretically to make sure you're still disabled. Well, if you have cancer, you probably still have cancer. A lot of people don't get their mail well if you're impoverished. A lot of people forget. A lot of people are ill. And, if you're disabled and you're in the hospital, or if you're disabled and you're feeling an incredible amount of pain that day, you might not even remember that you have an appointment with the welfare office. And you don't go
That's
in.
That's intentional.
You get cut off.
Right.
And welfare agencies always are churning people like this for both TANF, public benefits, and food stamps, and Medicaid. So they cut you off, and then you have to go through a process which takes time to get back on any of these benefits. And then welfare doesn't have to pay the money while you're off for those however many months, and then you might not win, or you might miss.
But isn't that the
need
point,
more
Arthur?
Data to get back on?
Right, right.
And it also, another thing that does.
You can tell he's done this for a living. Ken Barnes has done this for a living. I just want to let you know.
It not only does this, but it also has a chilling effect.
Yes,
it discourages people.
That's
you
the
sort
point.
Of want to give up. This is getting these benefits too much trouble to even bother, and I'm still going to get screwed. So it really is part and parcel of what you're talking about, Arnie, with this trying to end as much as possible the government's benefits for vulnerable people.
With disability, though, is not like those other programs where they say, okay, you're poor, you've proved it, here are your benefits. It's more than half of initial claims that are denied. Only like 20% of initial claims are awarded, and then even after that, very few succeed on appeal. So it's really tough to get. It takes like 2 years. And then the recertifications, these continuing disability reviews are much more involved than what you would go through if you were just telling the local nutrition office that you're still poor enough to qualify for food benefits.
Exactly.
It's pretty intense, and you're not going to be able to get a lawyer to help you with it as easily as you could for an initial award in which the lawyer has a chance of getting paid. So, and this is one of the arguments that the lawyers for Social Security claimants are now making, that just ramping up the reviews by itself is arbitrary and capricious, and people will lose their benefits for simply being unable to deal with all the paperwork, the trips to the offices, the trips to the doctors and such.
You see, I think what you just said is something that I would love to hear a candidate on the stage say.
Yeah.
When you realize that half of them are denied, maybe only 20% of them actually get their benefits, when you realize the nature of how disabled they have to be, and now you're asking them to go through more hoops, why? Because you can? Because it's moral? Because it makes sense? I in a lot of ways, I think, you know, we talk about the Trump administration and their inhumanity and the idea of how they sort of manipulate outcomes. I think this is a way of looking at people going, is this who we are? Is this what you want? This isn't about Medicare for all. This is, and you know, and the idea that we have the toughest disability benefit situations in the, probably in the world, also lets you know that we already start being harsh. So what's the upside to being harsher?
I mean, this is definitely who we are. It fits the pattern of how our politics has worked for the past several decades, for the past 100 years. There's just a built-in understanding in politics of who is served by welfare, and it's been thoroughly studied by researchers that racial connotations are at
everywhere.
Play in this. Even if nobody says anything that itself has a racial connotation, or if the proposals themselves are totally race neutral, it's just the way it works that there are a lot of people out there who vote who make assumptions about what population is served by the government when the government is trying to help poor people.
Can I just throw out one other thing that's an incredible barrier to people at these recertification hearings is that you have to not just jump through hoops. You have to get your medical doctor, your experts, or your surgeon, your orthopedist, whatever it is, to re-examine you in some cases to show that you're still disabled, and also to write a report. And then usually the reports from doctors who are pretty busy and just sort of scroll down something, this person is obviously disabled from their orthopedic problem, that's not sufficient for DHS, and then they want the doctors to do more. If you've ever gone to your doctor and asked them to give you a report that's satisfactory to some bureaucrat, oh my gosh, they you got to ask them 10 times to even answer you.
But they understand that. It's all part of the plan. Am I right, Arthur?
Absolutely, it's all part of the plan.
They played it out. So before I let you go, I did see one more thing. Since we are talking about the harshness of this administration, I figured why not add to the mix, you know? You wrote a piece at the Huffington Post about maybe a month ago, and the title of your piece is Trump is readying some kind of homeless crackdown, but his new homelessness czar won't share any details about it. So that was written back in the middle of December. Have you been keeping track about how our czar is doing on the homelessness? And what was the plan other than to make them disappear as well?
So the president has been really vocal about homelessness.
I know.
He talks about how the encampments he's seen in places like San Francisco and Los Angeles are disgusting. You know, he uses pretty harsh language to describe the people who are in those tents. And then it came out that administration officials are actually touring, you know, empty buildings, unused jail facilities in various places that they might like to use as shelters. And then they hired this guy, Robert Marbut, to be the director of the Interagency Council on Homelessness, which coordinates federal homeless policy. This is a person who I actually profiled in 2015. He's a consultant who goes to cities around the country and advises them on how to get homeless people off the streets. And the core part of the strategy is to build a big shelter, and that allows you to arrest or threaten to arrest people just for sleeping outside. The legal theory being that if there's shelter bed available, you can use law enforcement to get people off the street. If there's not, you know, that's a clear constitutional problem. So they hired this sort of shelter guru as the new director. I interviewed him about these reports that you're planning some sort of crackdown, that you'll try to encourage city police departments to just clear out tents and arrest or threaten to arrest people if they don't go to shelters. And he said, "Oh, I just started. I don't know."
Well, can I just say,
Arnie, that when Ed Koch was mayor of New York City, and there were huge numbers of homeless people sleeping on the streets and in the subways and everywhere else, Koch proposed that we put all the homeless people on barges and have them just circle around Manhattan.
Oh my God. But I'm reading something. So one of the things that we're realizing that actually is effective is something called Housing First, that it actually works with the chronic homelessness. Yeah. But guess what? The guy that Donald Trump appointed, he thinks the idea is ridiculous. I mean, that was the term he used. Quote, "It's the equivalent of going to a hospital without doctors and nurses. Four walls and a roof doesn't fix the problem." So how does a big, huge shelter fix the problem? Mm. It's got four walls and a roof. What's the difference? It's impersonal. It's warehousing people and treating them like they're chattel and not human.
It depends on if you think the problem is that you have to witness people living in squalor out on the street, or is the problem that people are living in squalor out on the street? An interesting thing about Housing First is that it was first promulgated at the federal level by George W. Bush's homelessness czar, and this was one of the key pillars of compassionate conservatism. And a lot of people think it's been proven a success. Unsheltered homelessness declined significantly since 2007. And now the federal government looks to be going in an opposite direction.
As you point out at the end of your article, and I just want people to hear it, advocates for the homeless don't hate shelters. And let me just say something. That's what when my husband died, guess what I did? I worked at the homeless shelter because I had no one to go home to. So I have met the people that are in shelters. And what's so frightening for me and for so many people is that they are me. You have this. You also have this image in your head of who is homeless, and then you work in a homeless shelter, and you go, "Let me disabuse you of that, okay?"
Right.
Because it will be shocking. But as you point out in your article, but these homeless advocates don't want the shelters to be part of a strategy that puts the homeless in handcuffs instead of housing, and that's ultimately what his czar wants to do. That's the threat. The threat isn't to protect them. The threat isn't to give them shelter. The threat is to say, you choose this, or guess what? You're arrested. And that's not a choice for the homeless.
But, yeah, they're being a little mysterious. He declined to confirm that that's what they're going to do. But he said, I just started my job. I can't tell you what we're planning.
Well,
so
do me a favor. Do a follow-up.
Something to watch for in the new year.
Yeah, exactly. I said, here's your assignment, Arthur. You got to do a follow-up because I'm dying to know what he's going to do.
And, Arthur, also, while you're doing that follow-up, you might look at some of the lawsuits that were brought in the 80s in New York during the homeless crisis under Reagan.
Yeah.
Because there were a lot of lawsuits brought by Legal Aid which were successful in ruling that it was unconstitutional to forcibly gather homeless people and make them go to
places. The Supreme Court just ruled on one of these. They declined to take a case where Boise, Idaho, was told it could not round people. You cannot arrest people for sleeping outside when there's no shelter bed. You know, that's just contrary to our Constitution.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for that. The other article we're talking about now is Trump is readying some kind of homeless crackdown, but his new homelessness czar won't share any details about it. Wow, it sounds just like what happened with the imminent threat from Soleimani. Anyway, on that note, Arthur Delaney, thank you so much, and keep writing for the Huffington Post.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. Oh, my God. You know, you just mentioned Reagan during the 80s with the whole idea with the homelessness.
Yeah.
What did I talk about? I was talking about Reagan in the 80s with cutting Social Security disability. So if you want the template, go back to the 80s, see what Reagan did, see what the response is, just move it forward to 2020.
Exactly.
Exactly the same thing.
There was a huge class action when Reagan tried to cut children's SSI benefits. And SSI is for poor children, not like SSD, which is the one for people who paid into the system. Obviously, children didn't pay into
any
system.
Exactly.
So they were just impoverished.
Right.
And there's this huge class action called Zebley, which won and said that you couldn't cut these children off as arbitrarily as you were doing. You have to look at each individual case by case.
I want a Democratic candidate during the debate to figure out a way to tell this story because it's just about our inhumanity.
Right.
You know, it's like be harsh on the most vulnerable, but But don't ask Amazon to pay a dime.
Yeah.
Okay.
And
don't
telling
ask
this
Amazon.
Story means interweaving all of these stories
exactly.
that we've been
exactly.
telling because
right,
it's a consistent pattern.
All right. When we end with sisters are doing
sisters
it?
Are doing it for themselves. That's in tribute to the first discussion, and it's by the Eurythmics.
All right. Here we go. Eurythmics.